ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
God damn it! Viva la revolution!
Now look at this, an orange ball, which no one's ever thought of. See, you're already following it way better. Look at his eyes.
Will you be brave?
Yes.
Will you be brave?
I try very hard to be in control of her and everything, but may as well not even be there at all.
Eu fosse você, me escafiadia.
Why didn't you want to do the role?
Hello and welcome to The Screen Show. Jason DeRosso with you on ABC Radio National. The Oscars are on this weekend. You've just heard a selection of clips from some of the most acclaimed films nominated. And we've been interviewing the filmmakers behind these movies for the past 12 months. So this week, we thought we'd bring you some of those conversations in the lead up to what is Hollywood's premier awards ceremony. And we begin with a film with 13 nominations, including Best Picture, of course, Best Director, and Best Actor.
Rise and shine.
Bat an eyelash.
Good morning.
There are no hands on the clock.
Why?
Because they're not needed.
What time is it?
I don't remember that part. All right, let's just not nitpick over the password stuff. Look, this is Bob Ferguson. All right, you just called my house. Let's cut the. I need the rendezvous point.
What time is it?
Look, Steve Lockjaw just attacked my home. I lost my daughter. This is Bob Ferguson. You understand?
Right.
I don't remember any more of this. I don't remember any more of this code speak. All right, let's just get on with. What is the rendezvous point?
Leonardo DiCaprio stars in one battle after another. He plays a washed-up revolutionary and fugitive who smokes way too much pot and certainly can't remember the old secret passwords from the old days. He's living under an alias with his teenage daughter when the cops come calling. Writer-director Paul Thomas Anderson has adapted Thomas Pynchon's novel Vineland for this story, and the film has one of the best performances I've seen DiCaprio deliver ever. With bloodshot eyes and wearing a robe for most of it, he spends the film escaping a small army of police led by a roided-up immigration officer played by Sean Penn. Both men, it turns out, are in love with the same woman, but she is long gone. Pynchon's novel was about 60s radicals coming to grips with their past in Reagan's America. Anderson's film reshapes the novel into a film about fascism today and the slippery slope of political violence. It's an allegory that maybe doesn't quite work, but Anderson's style is seductive and exciting. I spoke to him late last year.
I like the structure of the movie. We have a first act that's very chock full of a lot of stuff, and who you think is going to be the main character turns out not to be the main character, and I won't say much. But what we're left with at the end of that first act is a broken-hearted man who's got a baby. And now we jump into the main body of the movie, and you're visiting with your now substitute hero to the movie, Bob, played by Leo. And you're watching somebody who is completely stuck, and you realize why, because you've seen what's happened to him in his life. And I think you're seeing somebody who is the child in a relationship with his parent, with his daughter. You know, he's clearly the one who needs taken care of, but he's kind of still holding on to the idea that he's supposed to take care of her, and clearly it's the other way around. So their dynamic is very clear. And he's a guy who also, I suppose, has shifted pretty far just through the natural progression of time and gravity, has shifted into a kind of a crank, really. You know, there was a thing that I want to point out up where we shot in Northern California, over here where I'm from, in the area up in the Redwoods there, there's a common description for a type of guy like Bob, and they call them hipnecks. So they're half hippie and half redneck, you see. And they don't have much in common, but they have everything in common. In other words, they just want to be left alone. So that's the kind of character that we have.
Yeah. You know, struck me rewatching Licorice Pizza the other night that a lot of your films, in the hands of another director could be quite static films and very talky. And you're a director who likes to move things. You have a kinetic sensibility, even if it means characters are kind of walking and talking rather than just standing still. But, you know, you have set pieces and so forth. This is a film which is central to the film is a sense of violence. It's also, and political violence and state repression. So it can be very exciting at times. It's a chase movie in a way as well, a very shaggy chase movie. But tell me about when it comes to violence, and there's an early scene where we have sex and violence in a quite sort of perverse way represented on screen with Sean Penn's character. Tell me about your approach to violence here and what you think you're saying politically about political violence.
Which scene was sex and violence? Which one is that?
When we've got that early scene that involves Sean Penn's character being aroused.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, you know, she's messing with him and she basically sets a challenge to him to see if he can activate on the spot. And to her surprise, he does. So, you know, really what you're setting up there is a kind of, hopefully a kind of a playful and absurd dynamic between the two of them that prompts him to feel quite confident and excited by her. And hopefully you're starting to set up a kind of a sexual kind of dynamic between two opposing forces, you know?
Yeah.
That's the idea behind that scene.
The other thing I wanted to ask you is Leonardo DiCaprio, what was it like casting him and why did you choose him?
Well, I mean, why wouldn't you? I think is more the question. You know, he's so I've been trying to work with Leo for 25 years. You know, we talked about it a million years ago, and it didn't happen. And then we've stayed friends since then. And I think we both realized that we were starting to run out of time, and that it was about time to get to work or to get started to work together. Which I think that Leo obviously can give you a fluctuations of emotions within a second that not many people can. So he can be really, really tragic and really funny and incredibly lost on a dime, you know, but he can do very broad strokes that are needed, and he can do really fine point needlework. You know, what I mean by that is, you know, he can be this out of control dad looking for his daughter, kind of, you know, failing at every single turn, but he can be that human being who can sit his daughter down at the end and beg for forgiveness and apologize and try to explain a little bit of where he's been and what he's coming from. And he can do it in a subtle way. So, you know, Leo's Leo, and I think that we're lucky to be in a time where we get to have him as one of our movie stars, you know. It's our privilege to get to see him do what he does. He's just terrific to work with.
Paul Thomas Anderson, director of One Battle After Another, one of the most acclaimed films in contention at this year's Academy Awards. He was speaking to me last year. You're listening to the Oscars preview edition of The Screen Show this week, presented by ABC Radio National with me, Jason DeRosso. Now, the studio that made One Battle After Another is Warner Brothers, and that studio has been the subject of a Netflix takeover bid in recent months, but now it seems that Paramount will be the new owner of the studio in a last-minute twist to the bidding war. Whatever the case, Warner's looked to be quite an attractive acquisition this year. As a studio, it has 30 total nominations for its films this year at the Oscars. And those films include Ryan Coogler's 1930s set blues horror movie Sinners and Zach Cregger's Weapons, which is, of course, another horror movie. And 30 nominations is almost double what Netflix achieved and triple that of A24. The very fashion-forward studio that made this.
I have a purpose.
Okay. Let me ask you something. Do you make money at this little table tennis thing?
Not yet.
Do you have a job?
No. Backhand! Backhand! Forehand!
How do you live?
Well, I live with the confidence if I believe in myself, the money will follow.
And what do you plan to do if this whole dream of yours doesn't work out?
That doesn't even enter my consciousness.
By the way, when I say fashion forward to describe A24, my tongue is kind of in my cheek. However, I do know of at least two separate research projects looking into the appeal and the branding of this studio. They really have turned heads in Hollywood and now, it seems, in the world of film scholarship. Marty Supreme is their big contender at the Oscars this year, another film up for Best Picture and Best Director. It stars Oscar-nominated Timothy Chalamet as a bespectacled, spotty shoe salesman in post-war New York who has a dream to become the world's table tennis champion. Director Josh Safdie takes this idea and infuses it with a feverish energy. Marty Supreme is like an old silent movie two-reeler. It's driven by a pathological aversion to downtime, a 150-minute movie about greed, guns, girls, and ping pong. There are some inventive stunts, a bathtub crashes through a tenement roof at one point, and there's Gwyneth Paltrow returning to the screen in magnificent form. It's a gritty, sexy, sometimes overly too pleased with itself movie, a tall story about the American dream projected onto the world of 1950s international table tennis. You'd be forgiven for thinking this young man with laser focus was a kind of directorial alter ego. I spoke to Josh Safdie earlier in the year.
The conundrum of having a dream that no one understands is kind of instantly... the urgency of that comes into focus. When no one believes in your dream, there's a humiliation in that. In particular, the dream of wanting to be a table tennis champion is a joke to everyone in the world. Sadly, even today. Certainly back then, it was, you know, the sport was still relatively new. I mean, it was, you know, 50 years old, but it was something that it was somewhat of a novelty. I mean, the word ping pong is an insult to the sport. As me, as someone who loves the sport, I feel like I'm denigrating it when I resort to the colloquial, you know, the word name for the sport. It was designed to sell a game that you can buy at a convenience store. So I think that the humiliation of having this thing that he was born to do, that was what the gift that he was given. That is his path to glory. That is his path to, you know, ascend the existential malaise that he was in, the caste system that he was born into, the fate that his family saw for him. He was going to control his fate with his dream, you know, and that's, you know, I think the film is a heist film in that regard. Dreams are heists on fate. And, you know, his laser focus on that urgency comes from the, you know, as someone who went through that on myself with making Uncut Gems and even growing up and having a dream to tell a story, you run the risk of every day that your conviction isn't being supported or your conviction isn't understood is a day of humiliation. Every day you don't realize that dream or prove to somebody it's a worthy dream, it's complete humiliation. And I love that you say laser focus because specifically with Timmy, I wanted to feel a life of impairment with him, with his life, you know, so kind of the conundrum to his arrogance and cockiness. You saw that he had, you know, bad skin, but in particular, he had really bad vision. And so I put plus 6.5 contact lenses into his eyes and then negative 6.5 prescription lenses in front of it. And I'm not bragging and I'm not meaning to boast, but I have perfect vision. But I've always seen in other people when I, you know, I see you're wearing glasses, but when I see someone who has a heavy prescription, I can see the literal focus, the lasering in that's happening. And I always really like that because you can see a visual immediacy to this person understanding the world.
Let's talk a little bit more about his physicality on screen because it's quite pronounced, I think. And Chalamet's a great actor already. He does tend to almost do something different each film he's in, I think. And in this one of the first things I noticed, and it's maybe, I don't know, correct me if I'm wrong, it's almost part of a sort of strategy I detect in this film of deliberate anachronisms almost. His walk seems like a real kind of contemporary swagger in a way, but it's certainly at odds with the bespectacled, spotty guy who sells shoes, right, in the 50s. Tell me about the walk and how you approached, I don't know, the aura of this character.
I love that you're focusing on the walk. It's something Timmy and I worked on early on. You know, I was... I was shocked. You know, I met him before he made Call Me By Your Name, so I didn't really know him as, I met him as a person, as a young man who had clearly this intense dream and intense vision of himself. He was Timmy Supreme, and he had this energy, uncontainable energy, and I was shocked over the 8 years or 6 years that I knew him, 8 years before this film came out, is that no one was exploring that side to him. And, you know, I believe movies the greatest, you know, if you remove the fact that it's a fiction, nonfiction, you jump 100 years in the future, someone finds the films, they're just documenting the people who are in them and their souls. I'm like, wow, look at this type of person, look at that type of person. So I wanted to align myself with a certain sort of essence that he had. And then you use a character for the two of you to express yourselves through. And that's where the performance comes from, is the dialogue between self and character. And, you know, in particular, the first thing that we shot was a shot of a very simple shot. You try to, Herzog said, you know, first thing you should do is you get the whole crew, you get a chair, you put it in the center of the room, the whole crew centers around it, and you shoot the chair for 20 minutes from different angles. So you just kind of, you know, you can ease into production. I wanted to do a shot where the shot where Timmy, where Marty's walking down Paris. And it comes at a very unique time in his life because he was completely humbled in England. And here he is. You don't quite know what he's going to do. He's listless, but he still has an intensity to him, an urgency, and a, as you're saying, a swagger. And to establish that, you know, Timmy and I discussed what was going on inside of his head in that shot. And I came up with a whole narrative of what happened. He got caught in a lie in Amsterdam, and he heard about that while he was in Paris because someone bumped into that person, and he was trying to come up with a way to realign the lie. And it got him totally wrapped up in inside himself. And I said, and you're running late. So he's, you see that, you know, he did one take where he kind of took short strides. And I said, no, Marty is, he's leaping through life. And so then he extended his each step. So he's taking two steps for someone's normal one step. And Timmy did say, he's like, wow, this guy has like real swagger. So I appreciate you recognizing that. But there are people, you know, swagger is eternal. People had that, like, you know, Robert Crumb made a comic book called Cave Wimp. And it was about a caveman who was a wimp. Not all cavemen were alphas. And you know, I think that, you know, personality is eternal. Obviously, things get changed with time because of external influences like, you know, what the internet has done to speech and whatnot. But I've seen footage, you know, for that is so life-affirming to me when I see someone in 1943 storming through a block. And I was like, wow, look at that person. That's such a modern person. And that anachronism, it kind of tells you we've been the same since we were born as a race.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, is that kind of, could you say the same thing for your approach to music as well? I mean, there are moments in musically where you've got sort of 80s and new wave music on the soundtrack. And yeah, I am wondering about that approach to mixing it up like that on the soundtrack using those anachronisms.
Absolutely. Well, one of the first things I did when I jumped into this world before I wrote anything, before when I just stumbled on the world, was I saw this footage from the 40s in a British Open tournament. First and foremost, I was like, wow, what a dignified representation of the sport. It had such history. But there was these guys who couldn't stand still, and they seemed so modern to me. So my instinct was to play Peter Gabriel's I Have the Touch. The time I like is the rush hour because I like the rush, the pushing of the people. I like it all so much. You know, I just felt that was so aligned with these kids. And, you know, because I didn't want to listen to like the period music. I knew that stuff. You know, that was the fabric of their life. But what was the feeling? And I just instinctually put, you know, a Gabriel tune on, new wave music. And it felt right. It felt like what I was looking at was legend. It felt like there was a mythic quality to it, that the past was kind of haunting the future, and the future, in a weird way, was haunting the past. And I've always been interested in the way the hauntological culture has informed our present in a way. And, you know, so when I found, you know, when I started to look into why I was so drawn to the 80s for the 50s, I was shocked to see, you know, an entire of kind of literature online and discourse about the 80s being the first postmodern era, the first time culture started to revisit itself. You know, you have movies like Back to the Future that are literally set in the 80s and they're going back to the 50s. You have 50s fashion being regurgitated. You have Reagan coming and taking this concept of the American dream and putting it in quotes. And all of a sudden it became a marketing tool, the American dream. It was no longer the sincerity of what it was post-war, where America was coming out of victory. Now you have America coming out of defeat. And you're trying to go back to this opulence, this prosperity.
With Vietnam, the defeat of Vietnam, yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. So the chasing opulence, the decadence, the prosperity of post-war, but doing it through the kind of gloss or sheen that the 80s was trying to recapture, it felt so right to the exuberance of Marty.
Josh Safdie, director of Marty Supreme, which is up for 9 Oscars, including Best Picture, Actor, Screenplay, and Director. Here's Peter Gabriel from the soundtrack singing I Have the Touch, one of a few rambunctiously anachronistic song choices from the film. Jason DeRosso on the microphone. You are listening to The Screen Show. We are walking you through some of the highest profile films up for Oscars at this year's Academy Awards with filmmaker interviews we've recorded over the last 12 months.
Will you be brave?
Yes.
Will you be brave?
When shall we 3 meet again?
Our children's hearts beat. They smile, play. Never forget for a moment.
Mama. My next guest is Chloe Zhao, whose latest film, Hamnet, is an adaptation of Maggie O'Farrell's 2020 best-selling novel about William Shakespeare, his wife Agnes, and how the death of their young son played an important role in the creation of Hamlet. The film is up for 8 Oscars, including Best Picture, Director, Screenplay, and actress for Jessie Buckley. I spoke to Chloe Zhao in January and she had some fascinating insights into her creative relationship with Buckley.
As a woman, I have loved, was raised by, and still love men that are very similar to William Shakespeare's character in the film, who cannot express their emotions, and many of them don't even know how they feel anymore because that emotionality was shamed and repressed. It was never safe when they were young. And so to see what Agnes brings to Will's life and the way she helps him to feel and to point out there's an internal landscape, you know, even though he's still, the generational trauma is very clear there, even though he still doesn't have the healthy tools to express it. But what she was able to inspire him to do is to do it through his art. And that's a lifeline for him, right? And that then created mirrors for others who may not be able to express that, to come together. So the hopeful thing is that our lack and our trauma in some ways are also has the transformative power to turn into gold, right? Shadows can be alchemized into golden shadows.
Your early work, your first 3 films in particular, often in those films you embrace documentary techniques. Sometimes there are non-professional actors, improvisation and so forth. And I'm wondering if those techniques are still important to you and were important in your creative practice on this film, which is a very different film in one sense because it's a period drama, it's a costume drama.
I think so. And I think that is probably not, it's probably because something in me needed this way of working from even earlier on. And it's because I think it's because the way my brain, I'm neurodivergent, and the way my brain is constructed, that I do have a super detector for dissonance to a point that I can't handle small talk because I can feel the sadness behind the smile, right? So it helps me directing, but it also need me to, it also makes me have to make sure my actors are present all the time. There's no preconceived how this thing should go and how this character should feel, how should she grieve when her son dies. It's got to be present moment to moment. And whatever came through Jesse, for example, in a scene like that, none of us, even Jesse, didn't know where she was going to go. And so I would say what I learned to create the safe container for the non-actors to feel comfortable, I definitely brought that through and 10 times more in creating containers for my actors on a fiction film to be as present as possible.
I'm interested in how you worked with Jesse Buckley. Obviously, actors, sometimes it's quite difficult to get a lot of time with them before shooting begins, a time with them for rehearsals, let alone even extended periods in pre-production. But I understand with Jesse, you were able to develop a creative relationship in order to try and talk through or develop her character before shooting began. Can you tell me a little bit about that process and what it was like and how long it lasted?
I wouldn't say it was a long process. Like, she had another film right before. We actually only had her 2 weeks before we started shooting. But before I even wrote the script, I wrote it for her. And she and I had done creative dream work. You know, we have spent sister times together dealing with our own personal things as friends. We chatted about the character, but very little. We went to play with falcon, with birds. We did some falconry together, but very, very minimal. Because I'm looking for presence, right? So I'm not scared of not having time with actors. I trust that, you know, actors like Jesse and Paul, they do their own work. They do their own exploration. And whoever they were playing right before this, or wherever they are in their personal lives, those are all my clues. I believe in synchronicities. Those are all my clues in what they're going to bring on day one. And then we go from there. Let's see. So week one is nerve-wracking for me because week one, I don't know who these characters are. They don't know who they are. We're going to find it on the first day of shooting.
And when you say dream work, I think that was the expression you used. Are you talking about a kind of therapeutic exact term, or are you talking more metaphorically?
Yeah, so we're students of Carl Jung. And so, he is very, very much, believe that dreams are the language of the psyche.
Oh, and, yes, of course, the Jungian, right, yes.
Jungian, yeah, I am very much a Jungian person. And my teacher, who just introduced me to our dream work teacher, Kim Gillingham, is a student of Marion Woodman, who is a student of Carl Jung. So we come from that lineage. And another word is active imagination. Except in dream work, we specifically work with dreams. And I believe that what's exciting for me, the prep work, is to open the portal in the unconscious realm between Paul and Jesse and Will and Agnes, because the collective unconscious exists past, present, future. It's not linear, right? So And I also believe characters choose actors as much as actors choose characters, and stories choose us as much as we choose them. Isn't something we're controlling. So if it's chosen, then there must be a reason. And dreams, right? I just don't believe whoever created or however this world exists, that half of the time we're sleeping and dreaming, and it's just there for the not
for the
useful,
cells to regenerate or something. No, you believe there's something else going on.
Exactly. And if you look at indigenous societies, cultures from all of our past, everyone talked about dreams, right? And it's a language that we lost. So I mean, it was really exciting to open that portal. And we, Jesse recorded her dreams almost every day. And she will then do the dream work, give me the material, and I would take that material, throw everything away on the day, and just film that. And that's how it worked.
Chloe Zhao, director of Hamnet, one of the highest profile films in contention at this year's Oscars. You are listening to a special Oscars preview edition of The Screen Show this week on ABC Radio National. We're playing you excerpts from interviews with the people behind some of the biggest movies of the year. My name's Jason DeRosso.
I'm supposed to know how to fix this. I'm supposed to know how to fix her.
What is it you think it's your job to fix?
I'm asking you what I'm supposed to do. Can you hear me?
I would like you to get a good night's sleep.
This isn't supposed to be what it's like. This isn't it. This can't be it.
Everything is under control. Ah.
Australian actress Rose Byrne is another nominee in the Best Actress category this year for a film in which she acts opposite a character who we hear but almost never see. The film is called If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You, and it's set across several chaotic days in which Byrne plays a therapist and a mother to a young child with a digestive disorder who's hooked up to a machine 24/7. If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You begins when the pair relocate to a motel room after the family home floods. And we never see the girl, as I said. We just hear her. And we hear the constant whirring and buzzing of the machine that keeps her alive. It is a nightmarish vision of parental multitasking, sometimes darkly comic. And it's a story, as you'll hear, that's very close to home for writer-director Mary Bronstein, who I caught up with last year when she presented the film at the Melbourne International Film Festival.
Every decision that you see visually in the film existed at the script level. I was writing the script as a not knowing if how, when it would ever get made, but I was writing it as a pure howling into the wind self-expression that I needed to put on paper. And
this story reflects in some way your own experience as a mother of an ill child.
Yes, I went through an experience. My daughter is 15 now and very well and healthy and happy. But when she was 7 years old, she became quite ill. What I always like to say, though, and this is through a conversation I had with my daughter, is that her experience, what she went through, that's a story for her to tell one day if she ever wants to. That's very important to understanding this movie at a very DNA level, because on a script level, I wanted to concentrate on the mother's experience in this kind of situation. As soon as a viewer sees a child, your sympathy is going to go to that child, because that is how we are wired as human beings. And that is correct and right. We don't often see movies that are purely from the mother's point of view, where we're saying she has a child. This is not about the child. This is about the mother. And mothers are not given that space in real life. And I wanted to give that space on screen. As far as the visual choices that you're talking about, where we don't see the child, and we're so in Linda's point of view, we never see anything that she doesn't see. We're never in a room where she's not in. We don't hear conversations that she's not a part of. I wanted to really, if I could have gotten like behind her eyeballs, that's where I want to be. So on a script level, I made all of those decisions. And the script I started writing in the midst of the illness that my daughter was experiencing. The two of us had to go across country for a treatment. We were weird, demented roommates in this cheap motel with a tiny room. And the only way that I could find space for myself was at night after my daughter would go to sleep at like 8 o'clock. She was little, totally dark in the room. And I would go into the bathroom and turn the light on. Horrible hotel bathroom overhead light. And I would sit on the bathroom floor and literally kind of feel myself disappearing. Because when you're so present in caretaking, there's no room for you to exist. And I would start thinking about, well, what happens after? What happens after she gets better? Like, who am I? What am I going to do? What is life going to be like? It was a real, I would call it a real existential crisis. There was an immediacy into me needing to put it on paper while I was experiencing it. Then, of course, later I go back and refine it as a film. But what I hope is that for the viewer, what I was trying to capture on set was that immediacy of that feeling of, I must express this right now. And that's the intensity that I hope the viewer experiences when they watch the film.
Oh, I think they will. Absolutely. I mean, it's certainly something I experienced. It's a very visceral experience watching this film.
Visceral is a good word.
And hearing it as well. Because, I mean, it's such a subjective soundscape that you create that helps us enter into the emotions of all of this and the stresses especially, including the sort of drips and gurgles of the machinery that keeps your daughter alive at night.
Yes.
Your daughter's voice, of course, which we hear a lot.
Yes. That's very, very, very...
Well, your character's daughter. Sorry, the character's daughter's
voice. It's okay.
Voice,
I would get mixed up all the time too. So would Rose. Rose really, one of our first conversations was I said, this is sort of like... you're my emotional avatar, right? So I wrote the script, like you said, very visceral, very emotional, very personal. But now somebody else, I'm going to watch it from the outside. How trippy is that, right? And I'm also going to direct it. And I'm also going to be in charge of when this woman is suffering, when she has a moment of relief, and the pile-on that the universe of the movie does to her, right? And so it was very sort of a meta experience for me. But the daughter is played by a very, very, very talented actress named Delaney Quinn. You don't see her. She is there. I required her to be on set at all times when they have a scene together so that Rose in the film is never acting against nothing. She is actually performing a scene with a child. Whenever she's on the phone, the actor is on the other end of the phone. That is how I shot the film. And I felt like that was very important, not only as a respect for Rose as a performer, but also as a filmmaker. I wanted the film to feel as practical and real as possible in those moments so that when I was getting into, like you're talking about, the expressive choices I'm making with the soundscape, something can be so real and then something can feel so not real. And how those things are going together was very interesting to me as a filmmaker to explore.
Mary Bronstein, writer-director of If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You, one of the smaller films in contention for one of the big Oscar categories this year, Best Actress. It stars Rose Byrne, fingers crossed. That conversation was recorded last year at the Melbourne International Film Festival. Okay, next stop on The Screen Show's Oscar preview for 2026, we're heading to Brazil in the 1970s.
Plastics, did you hear that in here? People have no fear.
Olha, é uma sacanagem, um grau.
The Secret Agent is one of my favourite films vying for Best Picture this year. It won several awards at Cannes last year, including Best Director, Actor, and the Critics' Prize. And it's a film that is in some ways hard to describe. It's set in the politically and socially tense 1970s in Brazil. And at first glance, it's about a young researcher played by Wagner Moura, who's up for a Best Actor Oscar. His findings threaten the business interests of a malign, rich industrialist, and so he's forced underground to seek shelter in a community of dissidents. But that's only a thumbnail sketch of a very complex and layered film that's also very playful. Writer-director Kleber Mendoza-Figo weaves all sorts of weird and wonderful strands into this story, including a tribute to the movie Jaws and a B-movie detour involving a massacre at a gay beat by a demonic severed leg. Kleber Mendoza-Figo sat down with me at the Sydney Film Festival last June and explained his approach to storytelling.
Every time you set out to make a film and write a film, there is a moment you allow yourself to look for information, which is commonly known as research, but it's just a very intuitive search for information. So I go to the public archives where I can spend endless mornings looking at old newspapers from the 70s, for example, and I look at everything from classified ads to the movie ads page, police reports, real estate being sold at the time, you know, houses and plots of land, and the way people spoke and the way the newspaper used some words which are not really used anymore. And all of this information, it comes not in the right order. It comes in what I call the logic of life. And I think that some of the best books that I have ever read and some of the best films that I love, they do not have a strictly linear way of telling the story. I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I mean, you can make a great film with a linear structure. But I also love the logic of life applied to a film. And in my mind, because there's a lot of discussion now, especially with streamers and series, you're supposed to tell the audience what the hell is going on in 35 seconds. And I don't think you have to do that. I really think that when you come to see a film, there is an agreement between yourself and the whole experience. So you saw that the film lasts 2 hours and 38 minutes. So you go in and now you belong to the film. Trust us and we will get there somehow. And I believe that's the best. That's what I do when I go watch a film. It could be 3 hours, 10. It could be 92 minutes. But I belong to you now, and I trust you to give me something. And the logic of the secret agent takes a little while to to tell you exactly what's happening, but hopefully until you get to that point, you will be interested and engrossed.
Well, yeah, you certainly are. And I think the other thing that helps is that you're a filmmaker, I think, who has a really great connection to the subconscious. And I think when a film is fragmented and tells a story in a non-linear way, what are important are these subconscious moments or these visual aspects to the film, perhaps even audio-visual aspects that sort of anchor the film into your subconscious. And I mean, you begin the film with quite a striking crane shot, and we think it's just a fairly traditional establishing shot of a car pulling up to a service station, but there's a corpse. And really the corpse, the mystery of the corpse is kind of one that remains in some sense unresolved, but of course the whole film is about, well, to a degree it's about corpses and it's about violence.
Yeah, I mean it's very much like driving by an accident, and of course you can do two things. You can just move on after you see the accident and you see some nasty images that you wished you hadn't seen on the road. But you can do two things. You can park your car, which I would never do, get out of the car and start asking questions. What happened? Who is he? Oh, he's a teacher. I see. And what did he do? I would never do this. I would regret that I just saw this terrible accident with a dead person, and I would just move on. So I don't know who the person was. I understand that there was an accident, but in my mind, the body in the beginning of the film, I mean, we actually get information about what happened, but if he's going to be picked up and taken to a morgue, I don't know. Is it going to take another 24 hours for him to be picked up? Again, it's the logic of life applied to a dramatic scene.
I would love to see him get up on the podium and deliver a victory speech. That's Kleber Mendonça Filho, director of one of the most acclaimed films of the last 12 months, The Secret Agent. And it's up for several Oscars, including Best Picture and Best Actor this year. Jason DeRosso with you. You're listening to The Screen Show's Oscar Preview Edition, where we're bringing you excerpts of interviews recorded over the last 12 months with filmmakers whose movies are big contenders this year.
Why didn't you want to do the role? He wanted you to do it.
I can't work with him. We can't really talk. My father is a very difficult person.
Du kan ikke bare late som han ikke i byen, kan du det?
Ja, prøve. Er han?
My favourite film up for Best Picture Oscar this year, although I don't think it's going to win, is the Norwegian drama Sentimental Value. It's also up for Best Script, Director and Actress. It's a film about an ageing, egotistical film director played by Stellan Skarsgård who has a dysfunctional relationship with his two adult daughters, one of whom is an actor named Nora, played by Renate Reinsve. She refuses to ever work with him. The movie is also about filmmaking, and in particular, about one last project that the old man wants to make. A film about the generational trauma of a suicide in their family that happened in the family home, a wooden villa in the centre of Oslo, in World War II. The film also stars Elle Fanning. She plays an American actor brought in to audition for the role of the daughter that's actually been written for Nora. It's a moving, sophisticated drama about family, ego, and atonement. And I spoke to writer-director Joachim Trier in December and began by asking him about the character of Nora and where she came from.
I think the character of Nora comes from many places. When I write with Eskil Fugt, there's always a variety of motivations. One of them was to work with Renate Reinsve again. After The Worst Person in the World, I know her very well, and I had a feeling as a director that I could see her portray Nora as a more mature character. There's a naivete to Julie that Nora doesn't have, but I also think Nora was an opportunity to talk about someone who has a lot of animosity and anger towards her father and is, in a strange way, also very much like him. And why is she so different from her younger sister, Agnes, as we see in the film? And those dynamics of the family was very intriguing, we thought. And in myself, I mean, I think when I was younger, I was much more assured, at least in my 30s, about what I wanted to do. I wanted to make films, and Nora wants to be an actor, and I can identify with that. But the difficulty then of creating a life outside, a family outside, and I think that's really something we want to explore here. What is that longing for a home? And a place of connectedness that Nora is missing.
Yeah. When did the house become such a central focus for this story? Was it always the idea of the house? Because it is such a great cinematic device The notion of a house as a kind of camera, really, that frames human existence.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you for bringing up the house. It's very essential. It came quite late. It gave suddenly a key when we were creating the script here for a perspective of time. You know, when I was a child, I remember watching a documentary about how time is relative to the size of animals. Like for a fly, we move very slow. For an elephant, humans move very quick and so forth. So we thought, what would this family's history look like from the perspective of the building, the house that they've lived in? And it gave us a kind of funny essayistic way into the story. It's a portrayal there for that first beat about the 20th century in a house and the way the Second World War, for example, affects a family and all that stuff. All the stuff that has happened in the same rooms, the joy and the sadness, you know. But it was also like an idea that since the core of the film is not about the house, it's about family dynamics, that the house would show us how quick a human life is. And that was interesting in terms of the story of reconciliation. These two adult daughters, Agnes and Nora, they don't have an eternity to try to figure out what they got and what they didn't get from their father and how they feel about that. So I thought that was a nice framework for the story.
Yeah. I mean, it is a film that I think ultimately is quite a hopeful film, strangely. And Stellan Skarsgård's so wonderful as this quite overbearing and sometimes impossible father figure who wasn't a great father, but is this well-known director who's had quite a lot of success but is now old and perhaps doubting himself, and he wants to make this, well, who knows if it's his final film, but he wants to make another film. And it strikes me that ultimately, for all his flaws and the flaws of the other characters, without giving anything away, I think it's quite an optimistic film about perhaps the role of art. And it strikes me that you're a filmmaker who does process a lot of your own personal stuff through your work.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think you're onto something there in your description of it. I'm always hesitant when I speak about this is a film about artists, you know, the father is a director and one of the daughters is an actor, and I'm worried that people feel it's exclusive or that, oh, this is only a story for people who are interested in artistic endeavors or something. And it's not. I think that what I was interested in exploring is that there is an alternative emotional language in art that we all have in us. You know, I have two young daughters who are very tiny, and they, you know, they sing and dance even before they could speak. They express themselves in other ways. And I think even if Gustav Borg, this weird, difficult father character, even if he's clumsy and sometimes very narcissistic, in him is a hurt child that's trying to express something through art. And I think this is very often how it is. And this gave us kind of a way into their conscious, into a deeper level of communication or discommunication, if you want, that we could play around with in the film here. And I hope that people can recognize, even if they're not from an artistic family, like all that unspokenness, all the stuff you in psychology call transference. You know, you try as a parent to say the right thing and do the right thing, but ultimately you will at some point also fail and expose children to your vulnerabilities, to your shortcomings. And I think seeing that from two generations as a discourse in the film was kind of fun to play around with.
Joachim Trier, director of Sentimental Value, which is up for several Oscars this weekend, including Best Director, Best Film, and Best Actress. I think it's my favourite. And that is where we leave this Oscars edition of The Screen Show. I hope you've enjoyed it. Remember, to access the full interviews with the guests you've heard today, all you need to do is go to the ABC Radio National website, search for The Screen Show page, and then go back in time. You'll find them all up there for your listening pleasure. Thanks to producer Sarah Corbett. I'm Jason DeRosso. We'll be back with another episode of The Screen Show very soon. Bye for now.